Today on Life and Faith.
Did I want to lose my life over? Of course not. Was I aware of the risks? Of course I was. I was 26, so I wasn't that naive that I didn't know I was under a dictatorship that could kill me, throw me in prison, or end my career.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
Welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. My guest today is someone who will be familiar to two perhaps quite different audiences. He was a contestant on The Voice in Australia in 2019 and made it through to the battle rounds with his rich tenor voice that wooed the crowds and made him a bit of a favourite. Before that, he was an international cricketer. Henry Alonga was the youngest player to be picked for his country, Zimbabwe, also the first black player. Now, for people who care about these things, he played 30 tests and 50 one-day internationals for his country before his career came to a really dramatic end at the 2003 World Cup. It was in that tournament that Alonga, along with his teammate Andy Flower, carried out a protest against their government. At that time, in Zimbabwe, with Robert Mugabe in power, this was not a great career move. He was charged with treason. There was an arrest warrant out for him and death threats started to roll in. He lives in Australia these days, and when I caught up with him, I asked him about the factors that led him to take the step of engaging in the protest. Now, I want to take you back to 2003, to the World Cup hosted in South Africa and Zimbabwe. You're at that stage 26 years old, your cricket career is still going strong, and you and Andy Flower, who's a senior player in the team, decide to launch a protest against your own government. Now, what was it that brought you to that decision?
Well, I guess there were a number of things, and some of these things were kind of gradual. I suppose the first thing is my political awakening that had begun to grow round about my late teens, early 20s. I mean, I think it's fair to say that up until my early 20s, I was your typical sort of sportsman who was only interested in turning to the sports pages in the newspaper and interested in self-interest, you know, taking wickets, trying to score runs. I don't think I scored many runs after all that, but I was ultimately focused on progressing my career, as would any young person starting out in anything. But over time, I started to get more politically aware. Zimbabwe, of course, was a country going through some turmoil. A man called Robert Mugabe had been in power at this stage for 22, 23 years. There was a long list of things that had made people very nervous of his rule. Human rights abuses in the early 80s, where they estimate almost 30,000 to maybe 100,000 people lost their lives. In addition, allegations of him permitting, allowing, or maybe even encouraging corruption in government. Questionable elections. There were just so many things that were starting to ramp up and pile up. And of course, many Australians may well have heard of the farm invasions that happened in the late 90s, early 2000s. And all those things came to the fore to make this young man start to ask important questions like, okay, if my president allows the murder of people on their farms, what kind of leader is he to sort of condone that? And websites started to pop up all over the place, exposing some of the things that had happened that were hitherto up until then hidden in darkness. My conscience as well had been pricked for many, many years. And that's primarily because at the age of 16, I converted to Christianity. I came to a place where I decided that it was plausible for me to believe that this extraordinary place we call home, Earth, with all its abundant life, the variety that we see around us, couldn't possibly have just been the result of chance and time. When I look around at the beauty of Earth, when I look around at the complexity of it, up until my conversion, nothing made a sense that appeased my heart. I don't think whichever worldview you hold to, that it makes sense in the head. We're here, how did we get here? We don't know. No one has a camera that can go back to that moment. But we're here and we're conscious, we're sentient beings, we can look around us, take information in, and then make a decision. And this young man at the age of 16 made a decision that he believed that the story in the Bible about a creator made more sense than nothing exploding billions of years ago.
That faith journey was part of your political awakening as well.
It absolutely was. And then, there's some stories in the Bible that suggest what you ought to do when you're living in a country where you have an unjust leader and a man who's taking advantage of weaker people in society, or abusing them, or oppressing them, or holding them down, subjugating them. And so, cutting a very long story short, my Christian faith compelled me to stand up. And let me say this, you don't have to be a Christian. It's not an exclusive thing to Christianity that when we see evil in the world or wrong things in the world, that we can stand up and challenge them. But from my perspective, that was a very important part of it. I can't tell you percentage-wise that it was political awakening was 75% and Christianity was 25%, but
it was certainly a very important part of my protest. Mix.
And so I think if you add all those things together, plus some other little elements here and there about social justice and sense of unfairness, etc., sprinkle all that together and put it in a pot and mix it all together, and you've got a young man who feels, I've got to do something, I've got to say something, I can't stay silent.
Yeah.
I was also informed by the views of other people, of course. I spoke to many people. I read a lot around the topic. Some of the great quotes of people who did things of note in the past, such as Edmund Burke, who said, all that's necessary for evil to prosper is for good men to do nothing.
Yeah.
Things like that, the life of Martin Luther King.
Did your traveling with cricket play a part in this too? Like, were you hearing things that you might not have heard if you were traveling?
No, absolutely. I think one of the things that we came to realize in the midst of all the troubles was, when I say that, I'm talking about probably 2000, 2001, 2002, was the rest of the world seemed to be calling for sporting boycotts against Zimbabwe. Not exclusively the rest of the world. I mean, it was mainly Australia and England, primarily those two nations. Australia called off a tour. We had conscientious people like Stuart McGill saying they wouldn't tour Zimbabwe.
Yes.
England didn't come to Zimbabwe in the 2003 World Cup as a protest. I mean, they didn't say what the protest was. They said it was safety and security, but I think at the heart of it, they were saying, we don't agree with it.
It's not okay.
It's not okay. And so the rest of the world was looking in and questioning us, and we would often fraternize and rub shoulders with journalists who would ask us questions like, do you think Zimbabwe should be allowed to tour? Should it not be like apartheid South Africa, where you should be ostracized? We would toe the party line and throw out the usual status quo answer. Oh, we're just cricketers. We're here to play sport. Sport and politics don't mix. We don't get involved in that stuff, blah, blah, blah. And yet, on the inside of me, I kept feeling that perhaps the question they were asking was valid. And more sinister was the idea that some people were thinking we were apologists for the Mugabe regime, which we weren't. I certainly didn't see myself as that. But that line was being blurred, and so I felt, well, I've got to make it very clear where I stand on this. Yeah. I disagree very strongly with what's happening in my country. And so Andy Flower then approaches me. He then tells me about what he's thinking. He'd been approached by someone else. It wasn't his idea originally either. And that set the stage for what ended up being the black armband protest. It took months of massaging it and discussing, and eventually it was, let's do it this way. Let's wear black armbands. They will be symbols of mourning the death of democracy. And let's write a statement and tell people exactly what we're saying, because we don't want people second guessing us, making stuff up, because the media can fill in the blanks and we don't want that to happen. Mm. So we did it. I can't remember when it was early February, I think, maybe, when we did the protest. First match against Namibia in the World Cup of 2003, first match that we played, that is. And the rest is history.
It's a bit of a burden for a young sports person to have that kind of responsibility or feel that sort of responsibility. And yet you felt it keenly enough to take the leap, and it put you in real danger, didn't it? It wasn't just risking your cricket career, although it did do that. There's a much bigger risk than that.
Yes, that's right. I don't think this is unique to someone like myself. I think just about everyone can relate to how when you're in your late teens or early 20s, you feel somewhat invincible, somewhat able to take on any giant that you're given. And I think there was a combination of an empowering to be bold in that moment, going along with an aversion to risk, and also the righteousness of the cause. Now, I sometimes flippantly joke about the fact that prior to doing the protest, I was watching the movie Gladiator on a loop, mm-hmm. at least the scene where Russell Crowe is in the arena, and he's Maximus, of course, and the Emperor comes down, and his slaves have slaughtered these other professional fighters, and he wants to meet them. And I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't watched it, but it's quite an iconic scene in which the slave reveals himself actually to have been sort of the commander of the legion of the army, of I forget who the former leader was. He said he was Maximus Decimus Meridius. And the look on the emperor's face, and of course from then on the plot is revealed, and he then tries to kill Maximus. But for me, that story rings true to a story that we also find in the Bible, which is David and Goliath, where the most unlikely antagonist is fighting the most unlikely protagonist. And David, this young boy, faces a giant. Parallel that with this young cricketer who has no power but his own voice and a black armband and a piece of paper with a statement on it, facing up to a dictator who has money, wealth, the army, the police behind him. And you can kind of see the parallels that can be drawn with my experience versus those of others that have been documented. And in that moment, I did feel like a David. In that moment, I did feel like a Maximus who had a cause worth fighting for and worth paying a price for. Now, did I want to lose my life over? Of course not. Was I aware of the risks? Of course I was. I was 26.
Yeah.
So I wasn't that naive that I didn't know I was under a dictatorship that could kill me, throw me in prison, or end my career. I knew that I could pay the ultimate price. But once again, so strong was my conviction that we saw it through, even through the nervous moments. And the night before, there were nervous moments. The morning of the match, there were nervous moments. And we said to each other, myself and Eddie, if any of us wants to pull out, then we won't do it. And of course, we saw it through. But, you know, ultimately, I've shared this story many times, of course, but one of the things I don't share often is the fact that my life actually got preserved because of divine intervention. Let me summarize. We did the protest. I got dropped from the side. I got dropped from my cricket club. I then got booed by my own countrymen consistently, just about every match. So Stephen Smith and Bancroft and Warner have got nothing on me. I know exactly what they went through. So after all of that happened, the worst thing that happened next was I got very plausible death threats. And and the other thing, they wrote horrible articles about us in the paper. So it all just came as a wave. But the death threats were the thing that made me stand up and take notice about my own mortality.
Yeah.
That's when you realize, okay, now the rubber's hit the road, and now it's time to face the music. And the one way of my preserving my life would have been if Zimbabwe progressed through to the next round of the World Cup, which I believe was called the Super Six stage at that time. And the reason that would preserve my life is because those matches were being held in South Africa, because we played our early round matches in Zimbabwe, but like New Zealand played their matches there, and once they qualified, the rest of the matches were in Australia. And so similarly, our matches were going to be in South Africa. And so us progressing through to the next round was absolutely key to my preservation. And the night before this crunch match, we were playing Pakistan. If we won, we'd go through. If we got a draw, we'd go through. But a victory was unlikely. There was such a good team. They had Wasim Akram and Waka Yunus, etc. And the night before, I got on my knees and I just said a little prayer. I can't imagine, it was very complicated. It was something like, God help. And I'd been a believer by this stage for 10 years. And if there's ever a moment that I needed help, it was then. And long story short, we got to the ground. We started the game, 15 overs or so. Perhaps they got to 70-something runs, and then it started to drizzle. And then it got a little heavier, then got the players off the field and put the covers on, and then it sort of threatened to stop, and then it came back, and on this went. So back and forth we went. And back in that tournament, there were no reserve days.
Yeah.
for rain-affected matches. So if we didn't get 25 overs per side, or 20 overs per side, I can't remember, it wouldn't be classified as a game. It would have to be abandoned as
a
draw.
You go through.
We go through.
Yeah.
And so, of course, that's what happened.
Okay.
It was very strange it rained. We have very similar rainfall to what happens in this part of the world. So we're in the Southern Hemisphere as well.
Yeah.
Very similar latitude. And so we have our winters, so May, June, July, August, I guess. And so January, February is
dry.
Hot and dry.
Yeah.
Well, it was a cyclone off the coast of Mozambique. On the night I prayed, moved 800 kilometers inland, and it just managed to get enough rain on that match to rain it off. And look, I'm not here to quantify that that was a miracle or that it was definitely divine intervention. I have no idea. But I know it saved my life.
Yeah.
And I know that I said a wee prayer and it seemed like what needed to happen happened. And so that got me through to South Africa. And in South Africa, if you will, the divine intervention didn't stop. I was gifted a free ticket by a total stranger right in the midst of me needing a ticket to get to England, to leave South Africa. This is after I announced my retirement, after we got ejected from the World Cup. And then I was given accommodation, I was given work. There was so much favor on my life at that time. And then I went to England, started a new life. And by 2004, I was married to my wife, Tara, who was from Adelaide. We had been friends for about 8 years up until the time we got married. And it was onwards and upwards from there. We started a family and then decided to come home, at least for her anyway, in 2015.
This is Life and Faith, and I'm speaking with Henry Alonga, singer, painter, photographer, and former Test cricketer, who found himself driven to protest against the Robert Mugabe regime in Zimbabwe. Now, Alonga tells this story in all sorts of places these days, often in schools where he's a real hit. And he's always keen to tell the role his faith played in the stand that he took. Now, I travelled around Zimbabwe for about a month in 1995 and I was sort of backpacking around the world. And in those days, it was considered one of the best places to travel in Africa. There's good infrastructure and roads and it was relatively safe. It's a really tragic story when you look at what went on there. So I asked Henry, what happened to his country?
Well, we got dictated, I suppose, you know. Zimbabwe, we were blessed. We are blessed. I shouldn't say were. Great infrastructure in the sense that what Mugabe inherited in the 70s was fantastic. Great schools built by the British, roads, hospitals, education systems, etc. Great center of commerce as well. You know, we had overseas financial institutions there. We had people like Old Mutual, there and Standard Bank and great farming, great tourism, great mining. So
yeah.
A lot of the things that Australia is blessed with, we too were blessed with. And what happened is, quite frankly, mismanagement, corruption, and greed, I guess. That took over. Mugabe got a little power hungry. He was deposed in 2017 after 37 years in power. Now, I know I'm not the most popular person with Zimbabweans, because Zimbabweans are divided. Those same people who booed me then probably still boo me now. But I reckon you need your head checked if you don't reckon that someone who's been in power for 37 years isn't a dictator. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, if you have true democracy, at some point, people will find a frivolous reason not to vote for you. I mean, it happens all the time in true democracies, right?
Yes.
It's very unlikely that in a true democracy, you last more than 10 years. And 37 years must tell you something. Either he's excellent in suppressing opposition, he's amazing at stealing elections, or he's just the best guy for the job.
For so long.
And if you're the best guy for the job, then guess what? The country should flourish. That you should be enjoying prosperity. You shouldn't be having people getting thrown in prison or being shot at rallies or all the kinds of things we've seen of late, farms being invaded and forcibly evicting people. Like David Pocock, the rugby player, he's a victim of Mugabe's brutality during that time. Australia's gain, of course, amazing rugby player, but he is a victim of that era. If you were to ask me to summarize it, In the late 90s, Mugabe, for the first time, had a viable opposition standing up against him. And that was called the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change. It was led by a man called Morgan Tsvangirai.
Yeah.
Some people may remember his name. And he became a man who could potentially have ousted Mugabe. And Mugabe just would not allow it. And so what we saw from then on, round about from 98 onwards, was Mugabe trying to not only destabilize that opposition party, but cling on to power by hook or by crook, irrespective of the consequence to the country.
I wonder if you could comment on that in that moment as you're building up to the point where you're going to make this leap, which it is a big leap to make. To what extent did your faith really play a role in that, or speak to you, or at least give you a sort of perspective on what was about to happen?
I think I was familiar with the idea of fairness and, you know, I guess nowadays we call it social justice, or at least I was aware of what Mugabe was, and by that I mean the fact that he was a dictator, but he was also a bully. And I think these are concepts that most of us get, is someone who abuses their power, someone who's extremely wealthy or extremely politically connected, can suppress people. And my faith informs me that we need to challenge such people. If I could use a scripture reference, there's one in the book of Isaiah, which is in the Old Testament, and it says this, chapter 1, verse 17 says, contend for the widow and the orphan, rebuke the oppressor. Mm. And it's Old English, but rebuke means give him a telling off, you know?
Yeah.
Tell him to stop it.
Yes.
And I think that was probably the underlying motivation for my faith allowing me to step into the black armband role, was the fact that Mugabe was powerful as a dictator and was subjugating people. And I had power of sorts, in the sense that I had a platform.
Yeah.
I had a platform from which to speak on behalf of my fellow man. And so I used it. And so there's more I could say about the spiritual motivation for me doing it. But I'll just say it was more a case of, hey, my fellow man is suffering, and I've got something to say here about that.
Are you glad you did it?
If I were to analyze it in the cold light of day, I wouldn't say I'm glad I did it, because it was consequential. There were things that happened that cost me. I lost my career. Believe it or not, I lost a fiance through it. Oh. I won't go into detail, but that ended after the protest. Of course, I left Zimbabwe. I left everything I ever accrued in that country. Not that material things are the most important things, but you know, even little things, my green test cap and cricket balls and stumps that, you know, my cricket kit, my property, everything was left behind.
Well, presumably friends as well and family.
Yes, many friends, however, left the country subsequently, and I moved abroad, and I catch up with some of them, and I've made new friends as well. But yes, there was great pain attached to doing it. I'm very careful to say that doesn't mean I regret it. I think if you give birth to a kid,
it's painful.
It's painful, but you know, once that child is in the world and you end up loving that kid, you realize that the pain was worth it. So someone would say, well, a child is tangible and you can place a value on a child. How do you place a value on the black armband protest? Well, one of the greatest things that I learned about myself was, one, I can step out of myself and not live a selfish life, you know. I mean, up until then, all I cared about was wickets and runs, and I didn't get many of those. But but I did sort of live a very insular life in which it was all about achievement and selfish interest. And to be able to step outside of myself and think of others was incredibly, it taught my soul something. For a guy who was just self-obsessed about taking wickets and scoring runs and trying to make a name for himself in the world, I'm glad I was able to put life in perspective and understand that taking wickets is important, but come on, when you've got a country that's burning, it's more important to stand up for people.
Henry, you were known as a cricketer, of course, but these days maybe even more so as a singer. You've been on The Voice and you're a bit of a star here with this now. Were you known for singing in the dressing rooms of cricket grounds around the world? Is this where this started?
Well, actually, it started a long time before that. I started my singing when I was in high school. I got left out of every play in junior school. I got to high school, I thought, I don't want that to happen again. I don't like being left out. So I auditioned for the play, and my first role in any play was as a girl in Oklahoma. And I say as a girl because I was at a boys-only school, and you had to get girls from somewhere if you're going to do these types of plays.
You were it.
I was one of them. I wasn't it. I was just one of many in the girls' chorus. And I was told I was categorically the ugliest girl they'd ever had in any play. But of course, I thought to myself, in a boys-only school, I think being described as a pretty girl is probably
not. So you were
not
happy to take the ugly tag.
I was happy to take the ugly tag. So the next year, I decided to become a tenor, right, to the bemusement of my vocal coach. And I was given the role of Marco in The Gondoliers, which is a principal part. I had a few more roles. I was the narrator in Joseph and his Technicolor Dreamcoat. I was in a play called Salad Days. I was in another called Annie, Go Get Your Gun. And then eventually, I got an audition with the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art. They loved my voice. They offered me the scholarship. But within 3 or so months, I was debuting for Zimbabwe as a cricket player. So the music went on the back burner. And of course, I'm now 15 or so years in retirement. And over that time, I've revisited,
yeah,
and developed and continued to sing. I've no idea what the future holds with music, but I suspect it's going to be a larger part of my life going forward than anything else. I'm under no illusions about how good I am. I'm not the best voice in the country or anything. I certainly was privileged to be amongst the top 24, but there are some incredible voices in this country. All I want is to be able to pay my way through life, and I'll be happy with that.
Henry, what gives you the most joy these days?
I think as I grow older, my idea of what brings me tremendous joy or pleasure has kind of morphed into simpler things. Just seeing my kids laugh, you know, hanging out with the family, watching a good movie,
yeah,
having a good meal. But most of all, I love sharing the goodness of the Creator. That is what I live for. I know it sounds weird. There are all sorts of things people can live for, but for me, it's the idea that I can share a story about the goodness of whom I believe is the one true living God with people, and they can get it. And when that happens, man, I'm over the moon. I am over the moon. And I know it's not for everyone. I know there are a lot of people here who don't give 2 seconds to the idea that there may be a Creator, and that's fine. We live in a universe of choice. You can do what you like with that. But from my perspective, when people get it, like I got it when I was 16, because someone took the time to explain it to me, I think that's one of the things that gives me the greatest rush.
This has been Life and Faith with me, Simon Smart. It was great to have you with us. If you enjoyed this episode, let your friends know about it and tell them why they should listen. It'd be great to get more people on board. Next week.
The beautiful thing was that I had felt for so many years that I was only worth something to people if I was on TV, or if I could give them some degree of leverage, or I could give them whatever they wanted. I had felt as though I wasn't really worth getting to know. And I'd almost positioned myself that way to this guy and to other people there to just be like, well, I could offer you myself. I could offer you my body. I've got these different contacts. I'm working in TV. Like, just get to know me. And what he did was he invited me to meals with his friends. And so for the first time in a long time, people would sit with me, and instead of asking me about my job, they would ask me how I was, how my heart was, and we talk about the deeper things of life.